Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest, Tennessee State Assembly, Jody Barrett, 69. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcast and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. And welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Jody Barrett. His Twitter says, Christ follower, husband, father, small business owner, attorney, conservative. There you have it. Says it all. His campaign website says, among other things, half a century ago, my parents came to Middle Tennessee with big dreams for a new life and new careers in farming and music. They set about building a horse and cattle operation on the banks of Spring Creek. They brought me home from Goodlark Hospital to raise up alongside the calves and colts and various other farm babies. His mother, Bonnie, after a divorce, was left homeless and nearly flat broke with four children to take care of. A member of the Dixon High Noon Rotary Club and the Dixon County Chamber of Commerce, he is an alum of the Chamber's Leadership Dixon County Program, and recently agreed to participate as a member of TriStar Bank's Community Council. He was asked to serve as local chairman of fellow Tennessean Fred Thompson's campaign for president. He formed a local committee and organized a fundraiser that raised more than $150,000 for Fred's campaign. Ah, what might have been, right? He says he could no longer sit idly by and hope that someone else will stand up for what is right and what is true. Once again, he felt compelled to stand up and step in to help his community and his state. Jody, Holly, Kids Avery, and Western Kentucky University are at Western, Jody, his wife Holly, Kids Avery at Western Kentucky University pursuing a BFA in theater design and technology. Aaron, 19, plans to attend UT Martin. And Sunbow, 13, is a competitive cross-country athlete and a member of the Royal Ambassadors at First Baptist. Jody says he couldn't be more proud of his family. Providing for them and protecting them from any and all dangers in this world is the biblical purpose of his life. Fantastic. Hello, Representative Barrett. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
I'm so happy to have you here. You won your election for D69 last year, 78.4%. 12,552 votes, I believe, to the Democrat. Candy Hedge, only 20%. That sounds like a pretty conservative voter constituency where you come from. Tell us about your District 69 and Dixon County.
Sure. So the district composes actually three counties. It's all of Lewis County, Tennessee, all of Hickman County, and about two-thirds of Dixon County. And it is largely rural. The largest city is probably the city of Dixon, and I've got about half of that city that I think is somewhere around the 20,000 population range.
Okay. And it's borders up right next to Nashville, right?
About 35 miles due west of Nashville on I-40. So where you are, you're at 6 o'clock on the dial and I'm at 9 o'clock.
That's right. All right. So what's your sense after watching Memphis and Nashville representatives do a lot of TV and raise their profile while insulting Tennesseans like you and I? Well, not so much me yet, but you for sure. After the Covenant shooting, do you think those two districts reflect Tennessee or does District 69?
Well, certainly out of 95 counties in Tennessee, there are far more rural districts and rural areas than there are urban districts like where those gentlemen represent. And you know, honestly, seeing them take this step into the national spotlight and kind of taking the Democratic Party in Tennessee, it is the end of the old South, what we call Blue Dog Democrat Party in Tennessee. That doesn't exist anymore. And what happened during this session with those gentlemen and their expulsion just was the final nail in the coffin. And full-on D.C. Democrat liberal politics are fully in charge of the Democratic Party in Tennessee now.
I think you're right. And this was your first term. How do you feel about the session just ended, aside from the theatrics? Did anything get accomplished that was a priority of yours? And were you surprised it was such a wild one?
Well, I think, you know, the main thing that I wanted to accomplish in this first session for me as a freshman was to really build relationships and find out who are the people that are already there along with the other freshmen that are coming in that I could work with, that I could trust, people that kind of look at things through the same prism that I see it through, maybe represent a similar district and have the same values. And that was definitely accomplished and was really my main goal. And beyond that, I got some legislative things through that were important to my district. But collectively, our caucus did some, you know, pretty amazing stuff, I think, even through all of the distractions that we had throughout the session.
So did you overall enjoy yourself, or was it a big pain in the rear?
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's like everything else. There's a two sides of that coin. I did enjoy it. And I've had some questions since I've been back home in the district after we've adjourned, and people asking, well, do you regret it, or do you feel like you would have not done it if you know now, knew then what you know now? And the answer is the crazier it got, the more weird things got, the more convinced I was that I was called to be there for this purpose and for this reason. So, you know, the stranger things get going forward, then the more I'm going to dig into my values and my background and just try to make sure I do the right thing every day.
That's good. So your district 69, unless I can't read a map correctly, got redrawn last year. Looks like it added Hohenwald and subtracted some of Columbia. How will that affect the demographics and your reelection, if you even
Well, it to? Certainly became a little bit more rural. Lewis County, I believe, has a little less than 11,000 people, total population for the county. And so there was a pie-shaped part of Columbia that or Murray County that went all the way into downtown Columbia that picked up some urban areas there that my predecessor, Representative Michael Curcio, had. And it was, for me personally, I thought it was a very big improvement to pick up Lewis County. It reminds me a lot of the area that I grew up in here in Dixon, Southern Dixon County and Northeast Hickman County before Nashville started taking off and growing and becoming more and more populated. Lewis County reminds me a lot of the community I grew up in.
Okay. And do you plan to run again?
At this point, it's only a 2-year term. So they say you're always running when you're in the state house of representatives. So yes, at this point I plan on running for reelection.
Okay. And do you enjoy spending January through April in Nashville? You don't have as far away to go, say, as some of the Blount County folks. Rep Ritchie's brand new to that. Or, you know, this is a pretty long state. Memphis is only 200 miles away, but, you know, Knoxville and Chattanooga are pretty far away. Is it a nice place to work?
Yeah, it's actually, for me, it's pretty convenient. It's only about 35 to 40 miles each way. So I go back and forth every day. I didn't have to stay in town. I actually only stayed overnight one night. The night before, I had two or three bills to present the next day so that I could save a couple hours of drive time and be prepared. But came home every night, got to see my wife and my son that's still at home. And so it kind of disrupted our lifestyle a little less than most, I would say. But it was also important for me to be able to come home every day and try to keep some sense of normalcy with my family and with my routine as well. And, stay away from some of the stuff that happens in the late hours up there.
Yeah. And stay in touch with your base there. I had the honor of shaking Mr. John Rich's hand just last month at his bar on Broadway, Redneck Riviera. He endorsed you. How do you know him?
So John and I graduated high school together. We've been really good friends since we were 17 years old. John moved to Tennessee from Texas when his parents were going through a divorce. And he was attending high school in Cheatham County and was planning on transferring to Dixon County Senior High School for his senior year. And so back in the early 90s. I'll be 50 this year, so I'll date myself. Back in the early 90s, we used to have lock-ins after the prom. And so those that chose to do so after the dance was over, you would stay in the building overnight, and they'd have different activities and things going on. Well, John knew he was going to come to school there the next year, so he showed up and hung out at the lock-in and played music. And I had a band at the time that I was a member of, and so saw him playing and walked up to him afterwards and introduced myself. And he told me that he was getting ready to come to school there. And so just told him, hey, I'd love to hook up, and here's my number. And it just turned into a great friendship. And in fact, he was driving back and forth from Chapmansboro, Tennessee, about 25, 30 miles each day to go to school. And so ultimately ended up spending a lot of nights on the couch at our house and saving himself some drive time down the way. So we just got really close during that senior year of high school.
Wow, that's great. Okay. Sure, you'd tell all kinds of stories, but probably not for public consumption on here.
I don't tell stories on John because he can tell stories on me.
Yeah, too good. And so you went to Ole Miss, right? Spent some time in Oxford, beautiful town.
Yes, went to Lincoln Memorial University for undergrad over in East Tennessee, in Cumberland Gap, Tennessee, and then law school at Ole Miss.
And decided to come back, make Nashville your home, or Tennessee your home for sure.
Yes. Spent a couple of years in Oxford in North Mississippi practicing before we moved back, and moved back in 2001 when we were expecting our first daughter to be born. So May of 2001, I started, moved in to a new house and started a new job.
Okay. So I mentioned another newbie, Brian Ritchie. He's been on the show. Your Bill, you and he had a Bill together. He was on episode 28. So welcome to the club. Before he was sworn in, even he was on the show, HB 405 would have been a good one. Why would a bunch of Republicans in a supermajority in a red state, they say, not want closed primaries? Why let Democrats vote in Republican elections, Jody?
You know, I think there's an older mindset that goes back to maybe a decade or so ago when the parties operated a different way, that in order to attract people, particularly independents, to the party, Republicans need to keep the primaries open so that we can attract people to come and vote for our candidates, and then hopefully that gets them attached to a candidate that they like, and then they fall into the party. I think times have changed dramatically over the last 10 to 12 years. And so now my mindset is, I don't know that the New York Yankees would allow Boston Red Sox fans to pick their next manager. So I'm not really sure why Republicans would want non-Republicans to be involved in electing who their nominees are going to be going into the general election.
They may want to take a look at the Titans in that analogy there. That could give us some help, actually. So you also led the effort with the National Guard to keep their jobs without vaccines. Did you win that one? I know former AG Slattery didn't, but was new AG Scarametti supportive of that? The Tennessee Guard administered 250,000 shots, 680 of them worked with the Department of Health and 1,600 man testing centers. Do you think the Guard was used well during COVID?
You know, that was a push to try to get Governor Lee to get involved and stand between our Tennessee Guardsmen and the federal government and protect them from what was coming down from the Biden administration. We've got a really active Guard unit here in Dixon County that a lot of my friends' parents or fathers were involved in. And so it was important to me to be involved in that. And it was back during last summer during the campaign. And, you know, ultimately, we were able to get some attention, at least enough attention to get our AG involved. But that, you're right, AG Slattery did not take that up and Governor Lee did not really take action. But when Jonathan Scarametti got involved and some other states kind of pulled together, we've now seen that the Biden administration has backed off of that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Jonathan right now. He's been on the show too.
He's a true patriot, and we're very lucky to have him in the position he's in.
We are. They are. And it's interesting that he was appointed by the Supreme Court, whereas the appointments that Bill Lee has been able to make as governor, we'll talk about those in a second. I do see a lot of lobbyists camped out up there in the Capitol. You probably saw that too, but not a lot of citizens. I don't see a lot of people getting up out of their couches and going up there on a regular basis. Some, of course, but not a lot. The actual voters. Do you get cornered a lot by special interests in the hallways?
I haven't had a negative experience working with the lobbyists. In fact, it's been the opposite. I've found that at least the ones that I've encountered thus far and the type of legislation that I've been working on are more complimentary as far as they're there to obviously advocate for whoever it is or whatever side of the issue, but they're there to provide information and a resource. You know, I've got where my office is located is kind of in the corner of the building. So I didn't have to deal with a whole lot of that traffic going back and forth outside of my front door. If they came to my office, they were there for a reason. And a couple of occasions, I was actually able to get some assistance. As you mentioned, you know, even with a supermajority, sometimes Republicans have a hard time getting other Republicans to come along with some of our ideas, particularly more conservative ideas. And so getting, when you can get a respected lobbyist that's been up there for a while and already got relationships built that I as a freshman don't have, and getting them to be able to assist, that actually has turned out to be a net positive for me.
Okay, that's good. What do you anticipate coming out of this special session that Governor Lee has called for? I'm hearing a lot of press saying that this is going to probably put egg on his face. At least 9 county GOP executive committees and county commissions have issued resolutions expressing their opposition to any laws that would change or infringe on 2A. What do you think's coming?
Well, it's interesting. Lewis County GOP Chairman Cody Mitchell was the first GOP to release a statement on that that I'm aware of. And so I'm proud that movement kind of got started in my district. And as I've mentioned, it's a rural district. And where I am, the Second Amendment is of the highest importance among my voters. So I don't know. It will really depend upon what the scope of area of focus that we're left to deal with. The governor can control that. Whenever he calls a special session, he will have to limit or narrow the focus of what it is that we can work on. So he can make that extremely narrow to where we only have one bill or one specific topic, or he can leave it a little bit wider and give us some room to navigate. So it really remains to be seen. What I can almost guarantee will happen is once it's announced, our friends that we just mentioned earlier who had a very theatric experience in their first session will mobilize their people, and there will be tons of protests and activities going on, and likely on both sides of the political spectrum. I suspect that we will see both the right and the left extreme wings showing up at the state capitol during that week or 10 days, whatever it is that we're there. So in that regard, I suspect it's going to be very tense and can get somewhat circus-like. But I'm hopeful that if we do anything or if we pass anything, that it will be something that is well thought out, well mapped out to the extent it can be in such a short period of time. But more focused on what the results are going to be rather than just getting something in the news media to show that we did something.
Okay. So the regular session in Nashville is January through April. So it's over. I do feel bad for the men and women up there that have real jobs back in East Tennessee, or like I said, Blount County, having to come so far away from their real jobs, homes and families for what might be a waste of time. And for what, $30,000 plus per diem. It is a hardship. It would have been nice to have gotten it all done in regular session, but I understand how these things go because nothing was filed regarding gun laws to vote on except Governor Lee did have that. Well, we'll talk about that in a second. So bottom line is, I do feel bad for these folks that have to come far and wide to get this thing done, and it may end up not being very productive. Do you expect any change in leadership next session with Lieutenant Governor McNally's public issues or Speaker Sexton and his residence? We still don't know the bottom of that. We already saw Campbell resign over sexual harassment, so that obviously has to have a special election. Do you think Speaker Sexton knew that Nashville and Memphis would just reinstate the Justins right away, or did he miscalculate the whole thing with the expulsions? They also have to be reelected now.
Right. No, I don't think that there was, I think there was an expectation that if they were reappointed on an interim basis, that the legislature would have the option as to whether or not we wanted to seat them. And I think ultimately, with consultation from the Attorney General with Johnson Scrimeti, I think the conclusion was that we could possibly not seat them, but it wasn't clear enough to where we felt comfortable doing it, making that decision, and it being a defensible position. We felt like it would be, or we were told that it would be in a gray area that we'd probably be creating some new precedent on.
Mm. And do you think Lieutenant Governor McNally is going to be back again? And do you think Sexton may fall for what's going on with him? Or do you think they're all there as long as they want to be?
Well, with regard to Speaker Sexton, I would be extremely surprised, which, I mean, with everything that's happened in this first session, I shouldn't say that I'd be surprised by anything, but I would be very surprised if anything were to come out of that. It's my understanding that everything that he's done was pretty well checked out and approved by the comptroller's office and all of that. So, you know, I know he's got detractors that are trying to come after him pretty hard, and so you never know what else might come out. But I would be very surprised if anything changes on the House side. With regard to Lieutenant Governor McNally, you know, I'm not sure. With the Senate operates kind of in its own bubble, and I didn't cross over very much to go over there other than to talk to co-sponsors that I was working on bills with. The sense that I get is that there's probably, I shouldn't say probably, I should say that there's a possibility that there would be some change in that situation on the Senate side, but that remains to be seen. So I will probably find out the same time that you do.
Okay, I'm not sure. Okay. So I guess back to the Justins, because obviously we're going to be dealing with this for a long time. Why did you vote to expel them? And do you think Gloria Johnson, the third J, should have been expelled too?
Yeah, so, and I'm sure you probably have done a little bit of research on this to see that I was one of the seven votes that voted no on expelling Gloria. No, the two Justins absolutely did everything that was specified in the resolution that was drawn up against them to expel them. And part of the issue was, the way the law has been, you know, expulsion is not something that's happened very often in Tennessee. And there's just this really wide berth between expulsion and censure. And what they had done, it was a culmination of things over the course of the entire session and things that had happened in committees and everything else. And it just boiled up to that point where they acted out on the House floor. They absolutely deserve to be punished, and they deserve to be punished harshly to try to set the tone to so that everybody knew going forward that sort of activity was not going to be accepted. And with regards to Gloria, she absolutely should have been punished alongside of them. Unfortunately, in my view, there was just an issue with the resolution that was drawn up with her that had some factual data in there, or factual assertions in the resolution that were not accurate. And then with regard to the testimony that was going on the House floor, interviews of her. One of the key elements was presumed that the megaphone was her megaphone, that she had brought it to the House floor and kind of made her more culpable to this master plan. And it turns out that wasn't true. And so all of that kind of changed the mindset while it was happening in live time on the floor. I think almost to a man, everyone that went in to that session before we walked in the door was expecting to probably see all three of them expelled. So, you know, as an attorney, having done some trial work, things change pretty rapidly when you're, and unexpectedly. And so you just kind of have to be willing to roll with the punches there.
And she didn't take it very graciously, because the fact that she did survive the vote, but then immediately went onto the CNN cameras and started telling everybody the entire state is just a crazy place, and that, you know, she's somehow righteous, made us all feel, at least from my perspective, very dark and gloomy. And had they voted on her before Pearson, and he would not, no, sorry, if she'd have been third and Pearson had been second, he would have not been there to cast the one vote that kept her there. And it might have changed some Republicans' minds as well, because, you know, she also would have been expelled. My big question is, had she been, do you think Knoxville would have sent her back, much more conservative district than Memphis or Nashville?
Well, her district is not super conservative, but the county commission that would have had that vote,
right,
is certainly much more conservative than Davidson County or Shelby County. That's for sure. She certainly would have faced a much more difficult reinstatement. And I think she probably would not have been appointed in all likelihood in an interim, and she would have had to run and get her seat back through the special election.
Yeah. And it would be interesting to see, because you can't be expelled twice for the same reason. But all of the comments that they made that disparaged the speaker, the House, the state, those comments could be censored or fined or some such. Sure. So it's not as if it's over yet. And they were not very gracious, obviously, in their return. The Metro Council and Shelby County Commission voted to reappoint Jones and Pearson, as we just said, just days after they were expelled. But a special session has to be held to fill all three seats, because the two-year terms have more than a year remaining. The Shelby County special election is projected to cost $400,000, and the Davidson County special election could cost $75,000 to $120,000, depending on whether early voting is needed during the primary, according to election officials. So this has a real-world consequence on these counties.
Sure, no doubt. And we're going to see a similar special election in East Tennessee too, in Representative Campbell's district as well. So, you know, these are very unusual circumstances. As I mentioned, I think it only had three, maybe four expulsions in the history of Tennessee government before this year. So certainly, you know, we learned something in this experience. I think the state also, and the population, the citizens of the state of Tennessee, learned something as well. And hopefully going forward, we'll learn from it. And I suspect we'll come back next year and do some changing to our House rules, and maybe even pass some laws that will allow us to have a little more flexibility in how we handle these types of situations in the future.
Yeah. And decorum, it has to be withheld. I mean, the little stunt trying to bring in the baby coffin was just too much for me. But okay, back to you. You were on NPR with Mary Louise Kelly. I'll be nicer.
She was great.
I know, but her opinions are a little different than yours and mine. But she
that's fair,
that she needed to remind you that people died on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. And you said you understood that, but she didn't press you. And I'm sure you know this, but the Capitol Police were the ones that killed two women outside and Ashley Babbitt shot inside. So no protesters killed anyone. CNN, of all places, said U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick suffered strokes and died of natural causes one day later. So it was a big lie. I found it funny, too, she didn't know what an SRO officer is. typical DC left-wing journalist. Do you feel like Lee's bill to add resource officers to every school is a good one? Compared to what we were talking about with Justin's saying pass something, pass something, pass something, do you think that's a good something?
Well, I think it's very interesting that that bill was already filed before any of this happened. And it was ironically the first bill that came up in committee the day after the shooting. And, you know, if you go back and look at the list of the vote on the House floor, I think there were four votes against that bill. The three folks that we're talking about plus one other Democrat.
Yep.
And I think that's just indicative of their mentality. Their mentality is they're not there to legislate or govern or find solutions. They are there, particularly these three individuals, are there just to be loud and be and make things as chaotic as they can possibly make it. So going back to the comparison to January 6th, there are comparisons there. Obviously, it's not on the same level, but there are comparisons to be made in that they were both trying to interrupt a legal government proceeding that was going on. And they were trying to do so by riling up an existing crowd that was there to protest, or whether that's peaceful protest or however you want to classify that. I have no doubt, based on my experience, personal experience of being there on the floor when this happened, both balconies were full of protesters. Plus, there were people out in the rotunda. And what a lot of the media has glossed over or fails to ask any questions about is what happened leading up to that point. And what nobody's really talking about is the two Justins in particular were going in and out of the chamber that morning for an hour and a half leading up to this. And as we were sitting inside, you can hear the crowd out in the rotunda. It was big enough. It sounded like a European soccer game outside. They were doing chants and getting loud. But they would ebb and flow with the volume. And the ebbs and flows would always happen whenever one of the two Justins went out into the chamber or outside the chamber to get them all whipped up and stirred up. And a couple of times during that session, Justin Pearson was up in the balcony getting the crowd inside the chamber riled up as well. And so when they came back in and when they interrupted in between two bills being called, one bill we just got through voting on, and the clerk was getting ready to call the next bill to be heard, they went to the well to overtake it and started trying to whip the crowd up into a frenzy, hitting the siren button on the megaphone and things like that. The intention was to try to get that crowd out of control. They were trying to cause and create chaos because that's what protesters and agitators do. They create chaos and they thrive in that. So that is the correlation between January 6th and what happened in Tennessee, is that you had people that were intentionally trying to agitate a crowd to violence, to chaos. And for that reason, they deserved everything they got and then some.
This is 2023, when we remember, you know, the millions of dollars of damage that was happening at the Madison Capitol in Wisconsin when Scott Walker was governor. And we've seen January 6th, of course, and we've seen what's happening in Oklahoma and Florida, all these state houses where violence does actually break out. And so those guys were acting much more like community organizers, much more like union officials than they were statesmen or people that you would want, like Jay Hooker or you in the Capitol building. So, okay, those guys, you know, they don't have committees anymore. So hopefully that this will be the end of their 15 minutes of fame. We'll see. But Matthew Bledsoe, a Tennessee business owner, has been sentenced to 4 years in prison. Albuquerque Head, also Tennessee, a 43-year-old father and construction worker, was sentenced to 90 months in prison. More than 880 people have been charged in January 6th. Should Tennesseans like Matthew and Mr. Head get amnesty?
100%. It's absolutely ridiculous that we have people who have been imprisoned without due process still awaiting trial. They've been held without bond or bail, without an opportunity to be heard in America. I mean, we're in the United States of America, in the constitutional republic that we have. The tragedy or the travesty that this administration has committed, the crimes that they have committed by trampling on our Constitution and the way that they have treated the folks that were there on January 6th is absolutely unforgivable.
I agree. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi was in charge of the Capitol Police that day, but now Kevin McCarthy is. And so you would think that there would be some movement, but I haven't seen it. It's going to have to happen at the state level. That's why I mentioned the two Tennesseans. And I just wanted to be sure to hear what you'd say, because, you know, nobody died in Tennessee in the protest either. Just three babies at that school and three adults. And of course, the killer. Wouldn't it be nice if Governor Lee gave medals to Rex Engelbert and Michael Collazo, I think is how you say it, the officers that shot the killer?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, that's the actual real Tennessee Three. If we're going to use monikers and give nicknames, the three gentlemen that rushed into that dangerous situation to save people's lives that they had never met before, that's the Tennessee Three. Those are the heroes that should be getting their names and faces all over the media, not these other idiots that acted like yahoos on the House floor.
That's right. They totally stole the spotlight, and I feel bad for the families. I've been saying it, the Tennessee Six is the victims myself. Why does he keep, back to Lee for a second, why does he keep picking out-of-state folks in his cabinet? You know, Penny Schwinn from California, she just stepped down from schools. She was, from all intents and purposes, not very good at it. He goes with someone called Lizette Gonzalez Reynolds from Texas. She's apparently Schwinn 2.0. And of course, Dr. Ralph Alvarado, which I don't have any comments on, but he is the health czar and he comes from Kentucky. Aren't there enough people right here that could do these jobs?
I would think so. And I was really thrown back to see that, as you say, kind of double down with another outsider coming in to run education here in Tennessee. I would have loved to have seen us move back in the direction of having a highly qualified Tennessean in that post. I think certainly out in the rural districts where I live, that the leadership and the parents out here would like to see that as well. And look, I don't have a whole lot of negative things to say about Ms. Schwinn. I wasn't there long enough to really form an opinion one way or the other. And I'll withhold my judgment of the new replacement until I've had an opportunity to meet with her and work with her. I can say, as far as Mr. Alvarado is concerned, he's been fantastic to work with. He is a true conservative, and his voting record in the Kentucky state legislature bears that out as well. And so I think he's going to be a real asset to Tennessee. I hope he sticks around for quite some time, but we'll wait to see. I think anytime you're pulling in somebody from the old Bush administration, to start working on education matters, I don't know that that's the best pool to be fishing in, but
especially since she was one of the ones who ushered in Common Core while Bush was the governor of Texas. So
that's right.
I'm not sure what the credentials are that we are looking for. Do you like Sexton's plan to give back Department of Education funds to kick DC a little bit out of Tennessee with all their strings attached, like CRT and sexual education? That's age inappropriate.
I offered to sponsor that bill for the speaker if he would give me that honor. One of the first questions I got on a radio show was asking me if I would support giving up federal funds for education. And my response was, not only would I be happy to do that, but I would crawl on hands and knees to the well to present that bill. So I stand by that today. I think that the only way to be truly free here in Tennessee and do things the Tennessee way, as we like to say it, is to be free of the strings that come attached to that money.
Yeah. And besides the Department of Education money, Sexton wants to reject, I like that nullification bill that would have given Tennessee ultimate authority to reject any federal law we deem unconstitutional, which could have meant vaccine mandates, masks, how we handle illegal immigration, what we teach in schools. I wish it was voted on. Did you like that one too? And do you think we'll see it again?
It will definitely come back. I believe that was Representative Bud Holsey that was carrying that bill. It's not completely dead yet. I think it just got rolled to next year. So it's not dead. That's still going to get pushed and talked about.
Yeah, and I don't want people to forget that Memphis is the crime capital of the world with 20 per 1,000 crimes versus Nashville, which is not good, but near 12 per 1,000. And your zip code doesn't even register. So why should all Tennessee legal gun owners get punished when it was subtracted? If we subtracted Nashville and Memphis, we're the safest place on the planet. That's what those Justins want.
Right. Yeah, I mean, as a parent with three kids, it's like punishing my oldest because my youngest did something wrong. It makes no sense, particularly out here in the rural areas where we are largely law-abiding, God-fearing citizens that go to work every day, come home every day, go to church on Sunday, things like that, to the large majority of this population. You know, we should not be burdened with limitations to our constitutional rights just because folks in Memphis and Nashville don't know how to act. Yeah. That's not fair to the people that live out here.
Agreed. And you guys and ladies passed some very nice bills to protect children this session. Now the federal government is suing the state of Tennessee to stop a new law that prohibits doctors from prescribing puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones to minors and prevents gender surgeries before the age of majority. How are you planning to keep our state's rights on those fights?
Well, I think AG Scrimeti is getting a lot of publicity in this podcast, but there's a good reason for that. I think having him at the tip of the spear for our state to defend us, he worked very closely with the sponsors of that bill and leadership to make sure that we had language that he was comfortable defending based on the Constitution. And so I think he's probably chomping at the bit, looking forward to getting into that fight.
Okay. I just got a few more minutes with you. I got a few more questions here. I'll try to do a lightning round. Drag queens. You did pass restrictions on that during the session. A pop singer named Lizzo, the big lady, was at Bridgestone and brought drag performers on stage to her all ages show. Should she be fined or jailed for flouting Lee's law against age inappropriate drag?
Well, I didn't see the performance. I mean, again, this thing has been called a drag show bill, similar to saying that the bill in Florida was a don't say gay bill. That's just a wrong moniker. The bill that Representative Chris Todd presented and passed is something that protects children against all kinds of sexually inappropriate performances, not just drag shows. So depending upon how the performers behaved on stage with Lizzo, that would determine whether or not there was a law broken.
Mm-hmm. And why not threaten the venues and the owners like bars with the liquor licenses or labor and industry fines that could put them out of business if they don't comply?
Well, there was another bill to that effect, a companion bill to that effect that ended up getting, I don't know if it got shelved or pushed back to next year, but it did not reach the floor for a vote this time.
Okay. So voice votes. Would you like to see the assembly side have to vote on the record like the Senate so lawmakers can be asked or thanked for their votes? For example, your bill aimed at cleaning up Tennessee voter rolls this legislative session failed in the House Elections and Campaign Finance Subcommittee by voice votes. I'd like to know what Republicans like dead and moved away voters on the rolls, wouldn't you?
Well, I think there are two parts to that. I do think that it would be transparency is a huge thing to the voters. We do need to make sure that we're acting in a transparent way. It's a little bit easier on the Senate side to do roll call votes because they're just not as big a body as we are. Calendar and rules, every bill in the House has to go through Calendar and Rules Committee. And if you come and watch or go on YouTube and watch a House Calendar and Rules Committee, in a matter of about 45 minutes, we will run through 50, 60 bills to get them set up onto the calendar. If we had to do a roll call vote for that, for every single bill, it would be a disaster. So there are certain areas where I think it makes sense, and there are certain areas where I think that, we need to be smart about it. We push buttons and have a board. We don't necessarily have to go through the names. If we were able to put that same technology in our committee rooms. And I think we could do roll call votes just by pushing a button. That would certainly make things more efficient. So there's a way of doing it. You know, and there's also there's two sides to every coin. There's also some concern that certain bills will get put in committee or in front of us that try to box us into a corner by the Democrats on the other side, just to get us on record for voting against for or against something. So, you know, I see both sides of the coin, but I think the voters, to a super large majority, would like to see us on record with every vote that we make.
Yeah. HB 1109 passed 74-17. Lee signed it. The primary concern here is, seems to do away with due process, allowing parents to defend themselves from anonymous claims of abuse that could get their kids taken away. How did it get 74 votes?
You know, honestly, you caught me off guard on that one. I'd have to go back. Is that Representative Littleton's bill?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, he sponsored that. The one that basically says that you can anonymously accuse a parent of not taking little Johnny or little Jane seriously, and they could be removed. But the parents don't have the right to defend themselves against their accuser, which would be due process, because it can be an anonymous claim.
Again, you caught me a little bit off guard on that one. I'd have to go back and dig into it. With 1500 bills, I can't remember every single one. But as I recall, I know Representative Littleton's the chair of that committee and works very closely with juvenile court judges, and that's her passion, is trying to protect children. So my guess is that the essence of that bill was to try to streamline the process to get these kids protected and get the process started quicker, rather than going through the whole reporting to children's services and the lengthy process that it takes in order to get those resolved now.
Okay. Last question. I think I'm in overtime now, but last question. Homeschooling in charter schools. You know as well as everybody now that only 1 in 3 Tennessee kids can read at grade level. We got a problem here. There's an overwhelming demand to get into the University of Tennessee for the first time, actually, but Tennessee kids can't score high enough to even get there. Governor Lee ran on expanding school choice, but so far only Chattanooga gets that. Shouldn't it be open to all kids with merit? And, you know, we have to fix our education for the future.
Well, sure. And I'm a homeschool parent. All three of our children have been homeschooled, and proud to have two of them that are in college now. One's graduating this week from Western.
Congratulations.
Kentucky. Thank you. So I'm big on school choice. And the thing is kids, there's no cookie cutter. There are no cookie cutter children, right? Everybody learns a different way. They have different strengths and weaknesses. For that reason, there are no cookie cutter classrooms, or at least there shouldn't be. And I say the same thing, there's no cookie cutter families. So everybody has different needs. Homeschooling worked for us, but it doesn't work for every family. And public school works for the majority of folks, or has for a long time, but it doesn't work for every family. It doesn't work for every child. And so we need, as leaders of the state and of our state government, we need to provide as many opportunities as possible to give folks options that are the best possible scenario for their children and their family, to give them the highest likelihood of success down the road.
All right. Well said. Representative Barrett, thank you for your time. We do appreciate you. We are at the end here. Tell everyone where they can go to find out more about you and follow you on social media.
Sure. I'm on all of the social media platforms. It's at Jody Barrett, or at State Rep Jody Barrett. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. All of my haters are following me on Twitter. So if you want to get in the mentions and have some laughs, those are fun. And then my website is jodybarrett.com.
Awesome. Thanks again for coming on.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Hi, I'm Tennessee Attorney General Jonathan Scrimeti, and you're listening to the Mill Creek View podcast. How you ever did without me.
Welcome to the Steve and Producer Steve segment of our show where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, what did you think of our guest, Rep. Jody Barrett, D69? Yeah, there were 2,000, but only 1,500 were accepted. Right, and they were pushed through. And if they said, if you can't dazzle them with brilliance, you gotta blizzard them with bullshit. So, yep. Welcome to May, Producer Steve. New month, same old political garbage, I'm afraid, as we just said. No plans on the booking calendar for two shows to record per day, thank goodness. You can't imagine how exhausting that is unless you actually do it. Hopefully, less controversy too. Time will tell. Political garbage and controversy will be with us a while yet, but on the bright side, it gives us lots of things to talk about and create content. Let's start with this happy note, clip number one.
3 weeks ago, my class and I were given this book to read by our English teacher. Now I'm going to read you a few pieces from this book, but before I do, I'm going to let you know that this book was read aloud by our teacher in a classroom full of my peers. On page 13, it says, quote, Margot's best friend started a rumor that the real reason he had blood in his urine was due to chronic masturbation. On page 14, it says, quote, bro, I saw your mom kiss you on the cheek this morning, and forgive me, but I swear to God I was like, man, I wish I was Q, and also, I wish my cheeks had penises. On page 37, it says, quote, my lovely boyfriend of low these many months is fucking my best friend. On page 41, it says, quote, I found myself feeling slightly bad for Jason. It wasn't his fault he had a micro penis. On page 276, it says, Ben starts. I spy with my little eye something I really like. Oh no, Radar says. Is it the taste of balls? No. Is it the taste of penises? I guess. No, dumbass, Ben says. Now I'm not sure how everyone on this board feels about this book, but this book was originally chosen by our teacher. When we asked our teacher why these disgusting comments were in the book, the excuse was that the book was coming from the perspective of high school students and that my peers speak this way as well. This is not the case. This is something I wouldn't feel comfortable reading in front of my own parents, let alone my teacher reading it to an entire class of students. These books do not belong in our schools. And my opinion on the book, like many others in this room, is the majority opinion.
Yeah. Well, that's a good young man. The happy note that I talked about is that there are young men like that. That's yep. A student in Auburn High School, Eagles. He blasted the school at a board meeting after a teacher allegedly read a pornographic book to students in class. There's a lot of Auburn Eagles in America, but I think he's at Renner, Virginia. But as we know, that could be just about any public school in 2023, unfortunately. And the left loves to say that the other side is book burners and censorers and Nazis because they don't want that in there, but they don't actually let you know what is in there. And it is not age appropriate, especially the teachers. They should be ashamed of themselves. I bet he's so glad school is almost out for the year, don't you think?
Oh, I think so.
Sometimes I'm glad that's over and that can't do any more damage, that we're past all this. We get the Washington State Legislature. Listen to these lunatics before we talk about it. Clip number two.
Just came off the floor. Debate on a piece of legislation
making sure that all of our kids, regardless of who they are, are being safe. Representative Macri, would you like to share with us what we've just done?
Yeah, so we just came off the floor. We are standing up for kids in our state, for transgender kids, non-binary kids, queer kids, kids who are seeking reproductive health care and need safety. You know, I heard from someone in my district who said, we are deeply impacted by watching elected officials debate our experience and our very existence. And we want folks to know that we see them and we love them. And I feel good about the work we're doing here tonight.
And me too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, gag me with a spoon, and especially that music. Oh, my
sorry,
gosh.
Yeah.
Dude.
Sorry to do that to you.
DMC, Washington House Democrats produced that thing.
Yep. You have to live under that tyranny. But from the wings, that was Rep. Marcy and Rep. Ty. They discuss SB, Senate Bill 5599, protecting kids seeking reproductive care or gender-affirming care. We must provide a safe and supportive environment for these services. Washington legislature cares about you, and this bill is a message to these kids. You are not alone. Can you believe that? The state wants to own the kids, not people who should be in charge of anything. One day the parents will change their voting habits, I pray. Oh, and Washington is removing the music curriculum from the education system because it's racist. Not a joke, they are. Music is one of the few languages that connect everyone around the world and allows brain development to think critically and be creative. Can't have that. No more Kurt Cobains, Chris Cornells, Duff McKagan's from Guns N' Roses, Jeff Tate from Queensryche, Jimi Hendrix, born in Seattle, Lane Staley from Alice in Chains, Screaming Trees, Dave Matthews, Brandi Carlile, but she votes for this stuff. Heart.
Kenny G.
You know, need I go on? Yes, Kenny G. Founded in 1923 as East High School at its present location,
Roosevelt.
Seattle's James Garfield High School yes. is known as the magnet school for the school's district accelerated progress program for especially gifted students. As a result, it has many college-level classes available, ranging from calculus-based physics to advanced placement studio art. Famous alumni of Garfield High include Jimi Hendrix and Quincy Jones. In 2008, Seattle's Garfield High School, Quincy Jones' alma mater, opened the Quincy Jones Performing Arts Center as part of the school's renovations. Steve, is that a good part of town or pretty rough?
I'm going to tell you what, Garfield is the number one jazz high school, probably in the top in all of the United States. It's one of the top tens, and it is basically mostly black and mixed race. And our children at Linwood High School occasionally got invited to go do the cool jazz thing and all this kind of stuff, coffee and jazz put on by a local jazz station. But I'm telling you what, Garfield every single year is the top. And if they want to remove that, you are removing one of the most binding things that keeps that community and that cult, that school together. That's
Oof.
Evil.
It's gone because of racism. Pacific Northwest Magazine, how Quincy Jones, Ray Charles, and other musicians defined the Northwest sound, March 10th, 2023. In 1947, a significant new teen band formed in Seattle when tenor saxophonist Charlie Taylor, a son of pianist Evelyn Bundy, who'd formed the pioneering Garfield Ramblers jazz combo here in the 1920s, met a far-leaning young fast-learning young trumpeter named Quincy Quick Jones in the band room at Garfield High School. Jones' family had moved from Bremerton to Seattle in 1944. In time, Charles would, of course, become a worldwide star who earned, based on R&B hits such as 1954's I Got a Woman, 1956's Marianne, and 1959's What I'd Say, the moniker The Genius of Soul. But back in Seattle, the jazznik crowd already had seen that Ray Charles' impact was utterly profound. His rootsy sound and inability and indelibly blue influence played a key role in the eventual rise of an original school of rock and R&B that would come to be known as the Northwest Sound. Black Lives Matter, right? There's nothing else to do there in the rain but make music and do drugs like Kurt Cobain and Hendrix. Guess only one thing left to do now. That's legal there. The drugs. Sad. Next up, how'd this start? How do we get here? Well, a little lady from Arkansas, by way of born in Chicago and Yale College, introduced a Hungarian billionaire to the Democratic Party about 30-odd years ago. And I do mean odd. Listen to this introduction to politics and the inception of a lot of our problems. Clip number three.
Not enough for America's future that some participate and others don't. We have been given an extraordinary blessing. And at this moment in time, our country needs us. And we need people like George Soros, who is fearless and willing to step up when it counts. So please join me in welcoming George Soros.
That's it, Steve. That's it.
Play it.
It is the first time that I feel that I need to stand up and do something really and become really engaged in the electoral process in this country.
He did. He is.
He sounded nervous there. Man, he has been emboldened ever since. His son may be worse. So we'll be watching that family name for years to come, likely until President Chelsea takes over. Well, not everyone thinks things are going great. Even Canada can wake up if pushed too far. Let's hear Douglas Murray.
It became interesting in January and February of this year. Why? Because you had protesters in Ottawa. Really interesting. When people come out in large numbers, and you know what the job of reporters is? The job of reporters is to go out and say, why are you on the streets? What brought you here? Why are you here with your kids? Why have you got a bouncy castle in the middle of Ottawa? That's a bit strange. Ask them questions. Just find out the story. But you know what? The government didn't want that in Canada. Your prime minister decided in advance that these people were, what did he do? All the modern excommunications. They were Nazis. They were white supremacists. They were anti-Semites. They were probably homophobes. They were misogynists. They were probably transphobes, etc., etc., etc. He did all the things you do in the modern political age if you want to just defenestrate somebody who's awkward to you. And then he brings in the Emergency Powers Act. Now, at such a time, what would the mainstream media do? It would question it. It would question it. The Canadian mainstream media did not. The Canadian mainstream media acted as an amen chorus of the Canadian government. I will give you a couple of examples. But, ladies and gentlemen, I could go on for hours with examples of this. You had a CBC host describing the Freedom Convoy as a, quote, feral mob. You had a Toronto Star columnist saying, quote, sorry for the language, it's a homegrown hate farm that was then jet-fueled by an American right-funded rat-fucking operation. Jesus, they can't even write at these papers anymore. CBC said that two Indigenous women were so scared to go outside in Ottawa because of racist violence, didn't bother to mention that Indigenous drummers had led the truckers in an O Canada rendition. The National Observer said that the many Black and Indigenous Freedom Convoy supporters were in fact duped by the truckers. The Globe and Mail reporter said, my 13-year-old son told me to tell protesters I'm not a Jew out of fear of anti-Semitic violence without mentioning that one of the leaders of the convoy was himself Jewish. Now, why is this so rancid? Utterly, utterly rancid and corrupt. Because in this country, your media, your mainstream media, is funded by the government.
I think ours is too.
Oh, yeah. So that was from the Monk debate on the mainstream media held on November 30th, 2020. The resolution to be debated was, be it resolved, don't trust the mainstream media. On the pro side of the debate were Douglas Murray, the Spectator, who you just heard, and Matt Taibbi, TK News on Substack, formerly Rolling Stone. On the con side of the debate were Malcolm Melk Gladwell, the New Yorker Revisionist History, and Michelle Goldberg, the New York Times. At the beginning of the debate, 48% voted in favor of the resolution, while 52% voted against the resolution. At the end of the debate, 67% voted in favor of the resolution, while 33% voted against it, representing a 39% switch to the pro side, the biggest switch in Monk history. Good debate. Clip number five, please.
in private practice for the last 16 years. I've been studying and publishing in this area for the last 5 years, including peer-reviewed journals such as Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism and others. I also have a patient who is a detransitioner. I think it's important to note that studies have shown that desistance or growing out of this condition of children by adulthood is very high, some 50 to 98%. I want to be sure before I give someone a very powerful hormone like insulin that they in fact have diabetes. What about cancer? Before we give any powerful agents such as chemotherapeutics or surgeries, we certainly want to have physical evidence of this problem, such as biopsies or imaging. Now, the gender affirmative therapy treatment proposed by WPATH gives very powerful hormones and surgeries. On what basis? Where can we find the gender identity to be certain that these children will not desist by adulthood? Can we use imaging of the brain or blood tests, genetic testing? Are there other biomarkers to ensure that we are correct? There is no such thing.
This affirmative model of care has spread wildly in the last 8 years. Now we have objective, unbiased, systematic reviews. These systematic reviews tell us the evidence for youth transition is poor quality and with very low certainty for benefit. In JAMA Pediatrics, there was a study reported from Northwestern University in Chicago. Patients ranged in age from 13 to 24 years. The authors concluded that mastectomy was beneficial and should not be delayed in youth. What led them to that conclusion? The finding that 3 months after surgery, the 36 patients were happy with their flat chests. They lost 9% of their surgical cases to follow-up. 9% in 3 months. It is absurd, meaningless, to draw any conclusions after 3 months. This paper is indicative of the quality of research we have in this field, published in our most prestigious journals. We have a serious problem.
Wouldn't be surprised in your state for sure. I got that clip from the TikTok account at @transition_justice. There's lots of goodies there. The problem is I've been shrouding this from the rooftops and I'm so sorry to read it finally happened. I didn't want it to. I wish I could have stopped it. I did everything I could verbally and in written form to prevent something like this, but it's not about me. One person died on my watch, and I'm really upset by this, but I want you to know it. A trans teen died from vaginoplasty complications during landmark Dutch study used to justify child sex changes. Major complications began within just 24 hours of the surgery. From International News, April 24, 2023, by Mia Ashton in Montreal, Quebec. A 2016 medical article documenting the tragic death of one of the participants in the linchpin Dutch study upon which the entire child sex change experiment is based indicated that puberty suppression was to blame for the young person's death. The case is that of an 18-year-old trans-identified male whose puberty was blocked by the Dutch researchers at the very early stage, meaning there wasn't enough penile tissue for surgeons to use to create a neo-vagina. Therefore, a more risky procedure used a section of the patient's bowel was necessary, which resulted in fatal necrotizing fasciitis. I don't know. Okay. Why, if they didn't have what they needed to use, did they go ahead with it anyway? It's murder, in my opinion. The manuscript by Nijin Born et al. Begins by saying that the absence of a functional vagina has a negative effect on the sexual quality of life of transgender women and explains that the multiple surgical procedures have been described for vaginal reconstruction in these patients. The patient is described as being a healthy 18-year-old for whom standard vaginoplasty surgery was not feasible due to having undeveloped genitals as a result of early puberty suppression. Dr. Michael Biggs, a sociologist who played a key role in exposing the scandal that unfolded at the soon-to-be-closed Tavistock Gender Clinic in London, spoke to this tragic case in a recent interview on the Wider Lens podcast. Biggs noted that while early puberty suppression for boys who experience childhood-onset gender dysphoria has the advantage of creating a more feminine appearance in adulthood, The major disadvantage is the penis remains that of a small boy, making vagioplasty much riskier. Instead of using the penile tissue, they will have to use some of your colon, explained Biggs. Now, of course, that means opening up your intestines, and that's obviously much, much, much riskier because then you have a different site, and of course, intestines are also messy. Jazz Jennings, star of the reality TV show I Am Jazz, faced a similar issue when it came time for genital surgery. Dr. Marcy Bowers, Jennings' surgeon and president of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, is on record saying that all boys who have their puberty blocked early will never experience orgasms, which surely casts doubt on the Dutch researcher's conclusion that vaginal reconstruction has a positive influence on the quality of life in transgender women. You think? So you ask me, do I think they'd let you starve to death if you were bulimic? Yes, I do. Yep. All right, last one. What's the world's wealthiest man have to say lately? Let's hear clip number 6.
Woke mind virus. How did it start? Was it bats? Was it an escape from a lab? I mean, what is your assessment of what? Because it's fairly recent. How did it start and why?
I was trying to figure out where it's coming from. I think it's actually been a long time brewing. In that it's, I think it's been going on for a while. The amount of indoctrination that's happening in schools and universities is, I think, far beyond what parents realize. I sort of came to realize this somewhat late. The experience that we had in high school and college is not the experience that kids today are having, and hasn't been for, I don't know, 10 years, maybe 20 years. So
aren't parents themselves also a big part of the problem?
I suppose in some cases that parents, but I think like the parents are just generally not aware of what their kids are being taught, or what they're not being taught.
They're letting the kids think that they're equal.
Let me give you an example that a friend of mine told me, which his daughters go to college go to high school in the Bay Area, and he was asking them like, well, so who are the who are the first few presidents of the United States? They could name Washington, and I said, well, what do you know about him? Well, he was a slave owner. What else?
Right.
Exactly. Nothing.
Right.
Like, okay, that's maybe you should know more than that. Yeah.
Yeah. That is the...
That was Elon Musk telling Bill Maher that the woke mind virus has infested the institutions and teachers are indoctrinating our children. Like I said, heard enough? I hope not. I'll be back with much more tomorrow, but stay tuned for my quote of the day. Welcome to my quotes for the day. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify and iTunes and hit the subscribe button and follow us. Go to all of them. Subscribe to us at all of them. While you're there, leave a comment. And thanks for doing it. We are famous for our three grand divisions of East, Middle, and West Tennessee, represented by the three stars on our flag. It is important, however, to remember that the blue circle around the three stars on our flag represent the unity of our state. I believe that Tennesseans have much more that unites us than divides us. Governor Bill Lee. I'm from Texas. I hitchhiked to Tennessee when I was 19 years old, and it is really beautiful in Tennessee. Steve Earle. We in Tennessee know that low taxes, low government, and less spending are the ways to grow our economy. Marsha Blackburn. They say that Virginia is the mother of Texas. We never knew who the father was, but we kind of suspected Tennessee. Tex Ritter. Tex Ritter was a pioneer of American country music, a popular singer and actor from the mid-1930s into the 1960s, and the patriarch of John Ritter of Three's Company, in case you didn't know. Canadian folk singer, music icon Gordon Lightfoot, whose evocative and poetic songs are etched into the musical landscape of Canada, has died at the age of 84. He was our poet laureate. He is our iconic singer-songwriter, said Rush singer Geddy Lee in the 2019 documentary Gordon Lightfoot, If You Could Read My Mind. If there was a Mount Rushmore in Canada, Gordon would be on it, said Tom Cochran in that same documentary. Well, that's it for this episode. Really hoped you liked it. Thank you, Rep. Barrett, for representing the folks of D69. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of mcview.us. Here's Gordon Lightfoot. It's beautiful to take us out. Peace in our time.
At times I just don't know how you could be anything but beautiful. Think that I was made for you, and you were made for me.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.